From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Like a fallen match that starts a wildfire or that one sniffle that sets off a whole school's flu epidemic, small events can trigger big change. It doesn't happen all the time, but sometimes when just the right combination of factors comes together, a major social change can take hold with the slightest spark. That moment is what our guest tonight calls the tipping point. 2 years ago, Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point, became a huge bestseller when he wrote about the idea of little events making big change. Today, we live in an era of big events, and tonight we're asking Malcolm Gladwell where the tipping points in the world are now. What life-changing tips are we in the middle of today, and how do events add up to tipping points in your world? You can join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. We're talking tonight with Malcolm Gladwell. He's a writer with the New Yorker magazine and author of the national bestseller, The Tipping Point. Good evening and welcome, Malcolm Gladwell.
Thank you.
Also with us tonight is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie, a senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Malcolm Gladwell, put the whole thing in context for us. When you wrote The Tipping Point, we were all trying to make out the mysteries of the new economy and what was sparking the changes around us in a relatively settled time. Now we're in a very unsettled time. Do little things still make the difference? How do falling trade center towers factor into your formula?
Well, big things always make a difference. So, you know, that the World Trade Center...
But do they? Do they necessarily translate into social change?
Well, they certainly... That's the kind of change that we understand. I actually think of the World Trade Center as being the most conventional kind of catastrophe, in the sense that that's what we... When we think about something that alters our lives, that's what we think about, something entirely unexpected, something extraordinarily dramatic, something, you know, incredibly tragic. That's how we normally understand dramatic change. That's the form we normally understand dramatic change to take.
And yet you had a lot of us persuaded not very long ago, and many of us still persuaded today, that even with big change, it's the interconnectedness of people that is the actual vehicle or facility of change, maybe even in the face of enormous events.
Yeah, I mean, you still need to have some – for something to really create a kind of permanent lasting change, it must – there must be a kind of cultural context to it. It must – you know, I like to think of knowledge and information and – behavior and all these things are extraordinarily social processes. They depend on the relationships we have to people, the kind of conversations we have with people, the way in which we relate with other people. And, you know, one of the things that makes – that has made this particular – the World Trade Towers attack so particularly salient now, I think, is that in many ways because of the all the extraordinary lines of communication that we have constructed in our world, the emotional message got out extraordinarily quickly and extraordinarily effectively in the wake of that tragedy. I'm not sure that a corresponding event, you know, the 100 years ago or 200 years ago, would have had the same kind of emotional impact to as many people. Just because we weren't nearly as connected back then.
Well, but there was Remember the Maine a century ago, and it took us to war.
No. Clearly, you know, this is not the first time an event like this has had that sort of impact. But the question is, how quickly does knowledge, not just knowledge, but also emotion, disseminate in a society? And one of the things I tried to point out in my book is that it is that process of dissemination that is really central in creating change. And there are, and you know, an understanding that process of dissemination, there are certain features to that process that are, I think, particularly unique to this moment.
Well, it's worth reviewing your sort of theory of that case. We spent a lot of time on this show trying to figure out what the appropriate response to 9/11 is. First of all, how to understand it. As you say, that's a process of sharing understanding in the first place. And then what changes are required to respond. You've written about how change can percolate right up out of the fabric of society, even without big events. In your brief form of that, how do you describe that process?
Well, I liken it to the process of social change to an epidemic, and I think that there are clear lessons you can take from the world of epidemiology and apply mm-hmm. them to the movement of ideas. So I look at things like epidemics. The thing that distinguishes epidemics is that the work in spreading the virus, whatever virus it is done by a very, very small number of people, incredible subsection of the population, incredibly small subsection of the population. I think the same is true for ideas, that the real work in spreading ideas is done by a very small group of people who have some sort of extraordinary social gift, and I talk about
it. It's counterintuitive at first blush that a small number of people could spark such a huge change. What's the basic mechanism there?
Well, the idea is when it comes to disease, it's that only a small number of people are extraordinarily social, that they have the ability to – they may have many more contacts than the rest of us. They behave in a way that the rest of us wouldn't. And if you look at people and ideas, you see the same thing, that in any group of people, for example, if there's, you have 100 people, there's going to be one person in that room who will know – 5 or 6 or 7 times as many people as everybody else. Mm-hmm. That kind of person, when they get a hold of an idea, is far more effective in spreading it than someone like me who spends all of his time in his apartment and never gets out.
This is what you call the law of the few.
Yeah, that's the law of the few. And that's one or another. Another notion I have is that if you look at epidemics of disease, what you notice is that they are extraordinarily sensitive to minor changes in the context in which they're operating. And I gave examples of a syphilis epidemic in Baltimore that just with the slightest change in government funding just explodes for healthcare clinics. But the same thing is true of human behavior, that as human beings, we are far more sensitive to even small alterations in our everyday environment than we think. Our behavior is profoundly influenced by cues that we pick up from our environment. I think that's the explanation, for example, for why the epidemic of crime in New York so dramatically ends in the mid-1990s, that small changes in the environment of the city trigger these wholesale changes in behavior.
Clean it up, fix it up, make it a little bit spick and span, and it doesn't look like a place for crime anymore.
Exactly. That's exactly what happens, which seems extraordinarily simplistic, but I do not believe that any other explanation for the why crime fell in New York is sufficient to explain the magnitude of the crime decrease.
The two other pillars of your theory, the stickiness factor and the power of context?
Well, we just described power of context. Stickiness factor is just the idea that ideas, when ideas take off, they aren't just contagious. They must have some additional element of being memorable. It's sort of an obvious point. But if you look at very, very successful epidemics of ideas, and I use the example of Sesame Street and Blue's Clues, which are these sort of learning epidemics, what distinguishes them is the particular effort the founders of those epidemics took to ensure, to deliberately engineer into the ideas they were trying to propagate this quality of memorability that they actually, Sesame Street is, and particularly Blue's Clues, was specifically created and tested rigorously to ensure that the ideas that they were aiming at 3- and 4-year-old kids were not going in one ear and out the other. They were more than just exciting them in the moment. They made sure that they were staying with them so they would have educational
benefit. Got it. And finally, in our quick summary tour, tick off some of the other tipping point changes that you describe in the book.
Well, I talk about everything from fashion trends, the rise of hush puppies in the mid-90s. I talk about suicide epidemics in Micronesia. I talk about teenage smoking epidemics in America. I talk about companies that have, I think, successfully used epidemic principles to spread kind of innovation and the ethos of innovation. And I really sort of try and go draw from as wide a variety of examples as possible to try and bring these points home.
So there you had a decade where you drew most of your examples where we were looking at, Blue's Clues and Sesame Street, at hush puppy fashion and teenage smoking. And all of these had dollars and eyeballs and all the other 90s buzzwords attached to them. Now we appear to be in a decade of potentially of changes on a much vaster scale. What's the connection, or maybe even what's the relevance of your theory? Does it still apply?
Oh, sure it does. I mean, one of the reasons I was so interested in describing word of mouth is that I believe that we are strongly moving towards a time when these informal kind of grassroots forms of communication are much more important, relatively speaking, than the kind of top-down information model that we've been living with for so long. And I think that's more true now than it has ever been. You know, that the, with the proliferation of, you know, everything from cell phones to the internet to the number of kind of media outlets, there isn't, you know, the, we've created more and more means for individuals to talk to each other, to their peers. And that is crowding out the kind of information we used to get sort of from the top. And, you know, 9/11 to me is the perfect example of this. The thing that struck me living in New York, in downtown New York when this happened, the most amazing thing to me was the sheer, was not that that this was this cataclysmic event that caused us to all behave in a certain way, but was the extraordinary diversity in the range of responses to that event. When I think of, you know, if I had 30 conversations about people's reaction to 9/11, I had 30 different I heard 30 different emotional responses to it. My best friend and I had, you know, 180-degree different responses to that event. That does not, that's a world that is being, that's a world that's a lot more fragmented. And it's a world where, and I think that's a function of the way in which we are forming our preferences and is profoundly different than it would have been in 1950 when we would have all watched Walter Cronkite and, you know, maybe read the newspaper and gotten, I think we would have, there would have been much more conformity in our response back then.
Jack Beatty, jump in with us. Malcolm Gladwell's describing how cell phone chatter and email and all the personal connections constitute, writ large, our response, even to 9/11. Do you see that as the seedbed of change that may follow on from that event? Is it sufficient?
Well, you know, he's very good at talking, at describing the propagation of sensation, emotion, knowledge. And the point that stuck out at me, that just to illustrate how this works in politics, with which I'm more familiar, is this idea of stickiness. When President Bush had his tax repeal, they repealed the estate tax. And what went into that was months of work in changing the label of the estate tax to the death tax. They did polling, and they found out that if you called it death tax, people said, wait a minute.
Who should be taxed for dying?
I mean, they're taxing you even for dying in this world.
Right.
And that rubric actually mattered in changing this policy. And by the way, the estate tax, that it only affects something like even less than 1% of the population. But even so, people out there in the public who would never have millions to leave said, I don't want you taxing death. That's an example of a sticky idea.
Malcolm Gladwell, what tip?
I was going to say with Enron. You know, Enron interests me because talk about it. I mean, it is such a wonderful example of, first of all, Enron tips about 2.5 weeks ago. And it's been percolates along. It was a scandal, and we were concerned about it. And it's percolating along. And then something happens about 2.5 weeks ago, and all of a sudden, it's like it's everywhere. And that's all we could talk about. And I was wondering, you know, did the nature of what we knew about Enron fundamentally change? I don't think so. I don't think we know dramatically more today than we knew at the beginning of the year.
Well, I wonder. I mean, there have been major revelations coming out day after day. You don't think that's sufficient to explain it?
No, but the storyline is the same, right? I mean, the essential storyline that someone, you know, like me who does not read every Enron story.
Sure.
But to me, the big thing was when they came out with the cartons of shredded documents.
Yeah.
And there is something about the shredded.
The body.
Yes, it's the equivalent of finding the body. The shredded document in American political culture means something. It's sticky. It's like one picture of a box of shredded documents, and all of a sudden we are flooded with a whole number of sort of images, associations, none of them positive. And all of a sudden we categorize this scandal in a different place. It used to be we could think of it as business scandal, something in Texas. I never heard of Enron anyway. But now all of a sudden when you see those boxes, you think, it's something else. I'm putting it in the same file drawer as Watergate. I don't know if that's the appropriate one. But do you know what I mean? It's sort of we were stowing it somewhere else mentally.
I do know what you mean. And yet it's not the 90s anymore. The Dow is down by about 500 points on Friday and Monday. That's not just a box of shredded paper. That's 30 or 300, some god awful huge number of $1 billion lost in that time. We're talking really big change right now with Malcolm Gladwell, who's traced the pattern of change, the tipping points of change, in his book of the same name. You can join us. What huge changes are we in the midst of now? Where are the tipping points in February 2002? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined tonight by Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. It was a huge national bestseller 2 years ago when little things were what we were focused on.
Still now, a national bestseller.
Still, even now, a national bestseller.
It's on the paperback charts.
And recently out in paper, now out in paperback, yeah. As big things, huge things shove into our lives. So we're trying to think about change and what tips the way we see the world, the way we act, the way our governments and corporations and nations work in a time of huge change. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. What's tipping into new directions in your life, your world? What tipping points do you see confronting America now? Join our conversation with Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm Gladwell, there are such big changes sitting in front of us. We're talking about the whole world in a war on terror, which we'd never heard of or even really imagined just a few months ago. So all the changes in security, both at home and abroad, all the responses to what that means in terms of our personal lives and government intervention in those lives. Now via Enron, the hour before you've come on, we have big conservative experts in this field talking about tectonic shifts in the American economy and the way businesses do business. Well, how do little changes dance around the big changes to direct where they go? How do little events survive or make a difference when such big things are going on?
Well, you know, one of the interesting things is about this kind of thing is that what I'm describing, these kinds of highly epidemic movement, contagious movement of ideas, what I think happens is that they perch on top of these broader, very general changes in and what you get is a series of these little kind of outbreaks of ideas that you wouldn't have had before. Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. It's an example that I in the afterword to the paperback of my book, which has just come out. Mm-hmm. I give the example of the Belgian Coke epidemic. Not epidemic. You know that scare in Belgium?
Everybody was afraid of Coca-Cola bottling Coca-Cola. Or bottles
yeah,
or something.
People thought they were being poisoned by Coca-Cola. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Turns out there was not enough. There was something wrong with the Coke, but there was not enough contaminant in it to make anyone sick. And secondly, most of the kids who got sick and actually had to be hospitalized because of they were throwing up and nauseous didn't actually drink Coke at all. They drank, you know, Pepsi or something else. Mm-hmm. It's a classic example of what people call a hysterical epidemic, which is quite a common occurrence among teenagers. But what's interesting about that is that there is a reason why there was a hysterical epidemic in Belgium in the summer of 99, and that is because all summer long there had been this very, very serious, profound, consequential discussion, scandal in Belgium about the possibility that there had been a dioxin contamination of the food supply in Belgium. So there was this extraordinary level of underlying anxiety about the food supply. And what you had because of that was this extraordinary, large, but in the end, completely baseless sort of hysterical outbreak over Coca-Cola.
But the stage was set by the larger concern.
Exactly. So what you have when, you know, same, look at anthrax. In retrospect, our concerns about anthrax were ridiculous, right? As I wrote this whole thing for The New Yorker pointing out that, you know, 20,000 people will die of the flu this winter, and we weren't running around and, you know, and four or five died of anthrax. If we were worried, going
to
be worried about a biological—
when you're not working in the hard Senate office building.
I know, exactly. But see, that's the same thing. I don't mean to demean it at all. It makes sense. Mm-hmm. Anthrax begins to make sense just as the Coke epidemic made sense. When you understand that what it was an epidemic, a contagious epidemic of a certain kind of fear that was operating in the context of a larger consequential shift in the way we thought about the world. And that's what I expect to see out of 9/11, out of Enron, out of all these things is we are setting the stage for these other kinds of social changes.
So looking at the large consequential shifts that we're now living in the hand of, what sorts of tipping points do you see these shifts, be it 9/11 or be it Enron, setting the stage for?
Well, the you know, I mentioned the anthrax scare. I don't think that's the last kind of we are clearly going to have outbreaks of that kind of anxiety, basically, where we will overreact to perceived threats. That to me is there's no way around that. That's an inevitable consequence of being in a heightened sense of having a heightened sense of vulnerability.
But that's a kind of flutter and a flurry, but that's not really consequential change, Malcolm Gladwell. What about consequential tipping points? What points do you see sitting before us or are we approaching?
Well, I wish I could predict the future. I mean, if I could predict the future, I wouldn't be on this radio show. I would be, you know, running Malcolm Gladwell Associates and, you know, charging $20,000 an hour.
Are you not?
I mean,
we just assumed you were, Malcolm.
No. I'm, like I said, the guy sitting in his apartment. I think the all one can say, it's funny because I am in the middle of writing a story for The New Yorker which talks about, the fallacy, the ways in which people, when they try to predict the future, mm-hmm. screw up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't look at that particular task without getting terrified of doing the same thing yourself.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think all I can say is that you know that we've set the table for a new kind of epidemic. What that particular thing will be, I don't know. I mean, I have no way of knowing. And it is the nature of these sorts of changes that they're utterly unpredictable. If we were having a conversation about crime mm-hmm. in New York City, and this mm-hmm. was 1993, I would guarantee that we would not have been able to find a single person in the United States of America mm-hmm. who would have imagined that the murder rate in New York would have been two-thirds of what it was in 93
yeah.
within the next 4 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's who would have guessed that epidemic was coming? It came and it utterly transformed our life. And it is the nature of these things that they are not callable.
Malcolm Gladwell, you're always provocative, and then yet there's this weird, sort of charmingly detached flubber professor detachment from an era of hyper change. Jack Beatty, here we are. We're all feeling the ocean swirling around us. Malcolm Gladwell is not going to tell the future. We don't expect that, but don't we feel some kind of impending tips? Is it impossible to read the tea leaves as we head into this storm?
Well, you know, I'm struck with the opposite phenomenon to what Malcolm writes about so interestingly, and that is how big things sometimes can make very little difference. Mm-hmm. And as I try to explain that self, for example, Columbine, that was when that event mm-hmm. happened, the shooting at the school, I thought that there was going to be a national outcry against guns and that we would have, at a minimum, trigger locks on all guns sold and the guns couldn't be – and I don't know what else. But I just thought, this is it. People are never going to stand for this. I was so wrong. And I'm trying to explain why the epidemic of fear that I thought was rife in the country and that the media was forcing on us didn't work. And as I explained it to myself, people immunize themselves, I think, against these epidemics when they are matters of – when they're from big things, that is when they affect politics or public policy,
mm-hmm.
and they immunize themselves against the epidemics often by ideology, by pre-existing mm-hmm. belief. And the pre-existing belief is held almost to say, I will not tip. You know, mm-hmm. the person who believes in something, you point to him the evidence that says you should be tipping because – your attitude should be tipping because we have just had this – horrific mm-hmm. thing happen. He says, oh, no, that's not evidence for what you think. That's evidence for bad parental values, probably liberal values. So ideology there has been a stop to the kind of change you'd expect a big thing to have, mm-hmm. ideology and lobbying, I would add. And mm-hmm. I think those factors are going to be at work both with 9/11 and with Enron. That they're going to be – people are going to say, I am not going to tip because my pre-existing belief is that, you know
– it would be wrong.
We can go it alone. Yeah, we can go it alone in foreign policy. We don't have to worry about third world poverty. Or my pre-existing belief is that we don't need any reform in capitalism. And in fact, that's the road to socialism. So you see, I think that sometimes in the political scheme of things – ideology and lobbying and other factors can really help people self-immunize themselves. Mm.
Listeners, we're talking about change. One moment, Malcolm. Folks in. Change with Malcolm Gladwell. He's author of Tipping Point. What dynamics do you see driving national and global changes today? What changes are you anticipating? Are little things still the key when the pillars of our nation, our world, are shaking? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Malcolm Gladwell, do you buy Jack Beatty's notion that maybe people can be inoculated against the epidemics of change?
I think it's a really good point. It is the very big nature of Columbine or 9/11 that permits people to immunize themselves. They can see it coming. And that one of the reasons that small changes can be so much more subversive in the end is that we don't see them coming, and we don't roll out the armor to defend ourselves against this tip that's coming. It's these little changes are subversive because they take us by surprise, I guess is the point. Columbine was, the minute it happened, that everybody in the gun control community was, in the anti-gun control community, was mobilizing their forces to prevent this from becoming a kind of referendum on gun control. Had it been something less obvious, more subtle, maybe they wouldn't have missed it. Maybe they would have missed it, and maybe something could have come of it. It's a kind of a perversity of political change in this country that does very powerfully support the notion that sometimes the smaller things can be more effective.
Malcolm Gladwell, give us one more example of how you see this system working out in your story of Paul Revere and William Dawes as a case in point. That's history we know well, but you've got a unique perspective on it.
Well, I was just interested in the fact that, Paul Revere is not the only person who leaves Boston that night saying the British are coming. Another guy does, this guy William Dawes, who no one has ever heard of. And the reason you never heard of him is that he doesn't do any good. None of the towns he rides through gather the next morning to fight the British. So the story must be about more than simply the message. It's about the messenger. And sure enough, Paul Revere turns out to be this kind of extraordinarily social personality that I think is central to creating an epidemic. So when he goes out that night, he knows people. They know him. He knows whose door to knock on. And that notion that change, in this case, will you take your eldest son and a musket and gather the next morning at Lexington and Concord, change is not possible without there being some kind of underlying social connection between the change agent and the listener. If the person doing the change is like William Dawes and doesn't know anybody, that's not sufficient. It doesn't matter how extraordinary his message is. He hasn't sort of laid any kind of social groundwork to make it possible.
And is that true even in a big media age where you can get the microphone and speak to the nation whether you know anybody or not?
Sure. In fact, the thing that impresses me most about big media these days is how much the public discounts what they hear in there are too many people shouting at us, and there are too, and we're so kind of removed from them that, does Dan Rather have moral authority? I don't think he does. But Walter Cronkite did many years ago from a number of reasons, but mostly because he was reaching a good deal more Americans, and there wasn't this kind of clamor surrounding the words that he speaks.
Listeners, what huge changes are we in the midst of now? Where are the hot tipping points in February 2002? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Jack is on the line. Welcome, Jack. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Did everyone notice that your electric bills went up a little bit lately?
Yes, we couldn't help but notice that.
Yeah, that's the small piece. The big piece that's looming behind that is the cost of energy. The oil discovery and production cycle has already peaked. They're not finding as much oil as they should be to feed our growing demand.
So there's a change that's going to be imposed on us, won't it, Jack?
Yeah. It's going to be imposed on us if we let it. We have alternate, renewable, endless energy supplies available to us that could be far more vigorously developed and deployed and get us ahead of that curve. But on our current path, there will be a time within one human generation, I think, where the cost of energy will be the single most important factor in changing all of our lives.
Jack, this is an absolutely splendid point. Let's put it to Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm, here's a case: energy conservation, alternate energy, that just droves of people have been writing and screaming and crying about for decades now, and yet the roads are full of SUVs. Why has this one never caught fire? Why hasn't change come to the American way of understanding energy in spite of the kind of perspective that Jack just brought us?
Yeah. You know, that's a good one. And it's a puzzle to me, too. I suspect, I mean, an economist would say, and I would agree with economists, that it's because the fundamental there is no connection between our long-term need for energy and the price of energy, that, you know, oil prices are at the pump are sort of artificially low compared to the rest of the world. And so we don't sort of see that scarcity reflected in a way that would actually force us to change our behavior.
So there's no context for it, no matter how golden-tongued the people who are promoting conservation?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, I think this notion that there needs to be, we need to be able to make these kind of warnings concrete in our life. And I don't know whether there is a mechanism. Small incremental changes in our energy bill are not, to me, a sufficient way of making this problem concrete.
Even when we hear that it could be a very, very big problem. Let's take another call. Sourav is on the line. Welcome, Sourav.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a very simple comment. It's about the two speakers tonight. Mm-hmm. They were commenting about how little things make a lot of change sometimes and big things sometimes go unnoticed.
Yes.
It's a very simple law of physics. It's not the thing that you're trying to move, but actually where that thing is. It's like if a very heavy box is resting on the ledge,
okay,
a small push would send it over.
Mm-hmm.
But if a very light thing was resting near something as immovable as a wall, you could exert all the force in the world, but it wouldn't still move. So I believe rather than the events themselves being the factors causing the change or the hullabaloo, it's the mental inertia of the people around them who receive or perceive the change is what causes whether a great change comes through or a big thing goes unnoticed.
Sourav, thank you for your physics lessons. Jack Beatty, do you hear Sourav as giving us the answer here? The boxes just aren't sitting on the edge of the cliff yet.
I think that's a very good. I think that's a very engaging a metaphor he just gave us. Mental inertia. I mean, we all know this. We have to reach an equilibrium with our environment, and that just means at a certain level we're not going to be moved. You know, we can't be susceptible to jolts. And a lot of life is a conspiracy against jolts. You know, we want things to go along smoothly.
And yet if 9/11 and Enron are not jolts that put
indeed,
our boxes at the edge of a cliff, then what
indeed,
is?
Indeed. These are. But the question is what sort of – how will they ramify in consciousness, in behavior, in politics? But, you know, just to take the example of the cars and the bills, I mean, suppose that we really tax gasoline at what was the real cost of energy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then the market – would do what no amount of government regulation and no amount of exploitation can do. We would all figure out ways to use less energy, and the market would drive our conservation. So sometimes, in other words, that could push the box to the edge.
Mm. Might indeed. We're talking with our news analyst, Jack Beatty, and with our guest, Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. What's tipping into new directions in your life, your world? What tipping points do you see confronting America now? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or check out the latest news at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking tonight about The Tipping Point with author Malcolm Gladwell, New Yorker magazine writer and author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference. He described in his book of 2 years ago, just out in paperback now, how networks of people and their connections, their views and attitudes can suddenly, quickly mount into great social change. So what about change in a time of big events? What's tipping into new directions in your life? What huge changes are we in the midst of now? Where are the hot tipping points in February 2002? Courtney is on the line. Welcome, Courtney. You're on the air.
Welcome. How are you?
We're well, thanks.
I was laying down, just taking a nap, and I heard you guys, the caller, call in about energy efficiency and whatnot, and I just jumped up.
We tipped you right off your bed.
So I'm not exactly in the flow of the conversation, but I would say that the tipping point that America has proven, that we're sort of lived by, was proven by 9/11, that we were tipped by catastrophe. And certainly in the case of energy, we're waiting, you know, with the SUV issue, we're waiting for catastrophe. Obviously, we're planning for catastrophe. We're waiting for the water to rise up and start coming up under our doors. So, you know, whereas opposed to, say, the European system economy, economic model, has, you know, in contrast to the private economic system, the free enterprise approach, that they have imposed social taxes to raise artificially the price.
And yet, of course, you know, that approach can lead to all kinds of blindness as well, and has in very well-documented historical instances over time. But, Courtney, stand by. Let me put your point to Malcolm Gladwell. Malcolm, Courtney's taking the other view. He's saying, hey, it's not little things. It's catastrophes that lead us to tipping points. That's kind of at odds with your thesis, isn't it?
No, I mean the I know you keep coming back to this, but I haven't fashioned a thesis that I think describes every single change that, you know, that's sort of the grad school student approach to. I'm interested in that that small category of change, not small but significant, but a category of changes that are propelled by these sort of subtle effects and that are magnified through these sort of social networks.
But the intriguing thing we're looking at here is whether or not, even in response to catastrophes, your kind of small grain events are necessary for change to actually mount in response.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I would say is that that if there is a energy catastrophe, it may well be the thing that triggers the catastrophe is something that would have seemed beforehand to be implausible or totally insignificant. Mm-hmm. I mean, what is it? The whole question is, how does one define an energy catastrophe? Maybe it comes on us very, very suddenly and unexpectedly because of something we had never even imagined. I mean, I suppose that's how I would choose to interpret that.
Courtney, thank you for your call. Richard is on the line. Welcome, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm calling because the whole idea of tipping point sounds nice in an abstract sense. And I do appreciate, I'm a history teacher, and I appreciate the guest's unwillingness to sort of turn this into a predictive model, because that is dangerous. Mm-hmm. But I'm a little troubled and a bit skeptical, because all of the historical examples that I've heard so far on the show just seem, you know, terribly flawed, particularly the one about Paul Revere. You know, he and Dawes and actually a third guy named Prescott all set out, and Revere never even finished the ride, and he's sort of remembered today because Longfellow wrote a poem, and I'm always suspicious that part of the reason he wrote it about Revere was because it was easier to rhyme than Prescott or Dawes. And the point about Walter Cronkite and his, you know, moral authority, which, again, was sort of a product of, I think, more the end of his career. During the 60s, his ratings were pretty much equal with Huntley and Brinkley. Mm-hmm. So in example after example, I'm just finding just a lot of factual flaws in the kind of argument that we're getting here.
Well, Richard, thank you for your call. Malcolm Gladwell, without tipping back into Revolutionary War history, is there a danger of being too glib? Richard says, look, it's just because Paul Revere had a nice rhyming name that we even think about him.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that had something to do with it. I mean, but we are. I mean, I am under in the constraints of a radio show representing a 250-page book.
Yes.
So I would urge the caller to read my book, and I hope he believes it's more solidly grounded. But and with respect to Cronkite, it's not a question of, I mean, I was saying that a media figure in general would have had more moral authority at a time when sort of the viewership of Americans of those shows was greater. Mm-hmm. I mean, today the number of Americans who actually watch the evening news is a fraction of what it used to be, and that to me is a symbol of how the dissemination of information has gotten so much more atomized today.
Fragmented.
Than it was.
Fragmented. Let's get one more call. Bill is on the line. Welcome, Bill. You're on the air. Hello, Bill. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
I just wanted to point out that I thought that one of the uses of media and a connecting was when Muhammad Ali came on after 9/11 and made his appeal to people to understand Islam and Muslims and that to look at them as people. And I thought this was one of those cases where the impact of a connector met with the media.
And infected or helped infect the country with a degree of tolerance that might not have been there otherwise.
I certainly want to believe that.
Mm. Bill, thanks for your call. Malcolm Gladwell, do you agree?
Yes. Oh, yeah. I think, I mean, there are these wonderful moments when somebody has a kind of someone's social capital is picked up on and amplified by by the media. And that's certainly an excellent example.
And George Bush, the president, is he a connector, a maven, a salesman in your terminology?
George Bush?
Yes.
Well, I'd say in my terminology, I don't think he's much of either of them, but maybe I'm just betraying my political prejudices.
Meaning he's not a change agent in your mind?
Not in that. Well, if we're talking about does he have the specific social gifts that I associate with people who start epidemics, don't think so. To me, Clinton, for example, is very clearly a connector, someone with extraordinary social gifts that he applied to his and that explain his political success, you know, which is not to demean George Bush. But I think the things that explain his political success don't lie in his particular social gifts. They lie in other things that he was able to quality he was able to draw on.
And already bringing changes, but we'll see how far they go. Malcolm Gladwell, author of The Tipping Point, How Little Things Can Make a Big Difference, now out in paperback. Thanks very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Jack Beatty, we've talked a lot about change. Does Malcolm Gladwell's thesis give you any better insight into what changes we may be in the midst of now?
Well, I really like his idea that there are impalpable changes and that the ones that we're not ready for, we don't get our ideological defenses up against, and therefore they can steal upon us and really affect change. And that's something. I mean, I think the whole campaign against smoking, for example, is an example of that, how propaganda over the years has begun to affect – well, it used to be half people smoke. Now it's less than a third. That's a remarkable achievement, and there's a tipping point there against smoking that is just driving it down and down, I hope. And that's in a matter, really, of behavior, isn't it?
It is.
It's just we're going less tolerant of it.
It is, and it does feel like we're in a world of tipping points, whether or not we can describe them yet. The world feels tippy. Listeners, you can read the first chapter of Malcolm Gladwell's book, The Tipping Point. Go to our website at onpointradio.org. In case you didn't notice, Special Coverage has a new name. From tonight, the show is called On Point. The new name formally marks a transition out of the all 9/11, all the time coverage, which regular listeners know we've already begun to make. The change also marks something far more significant. A show that was launched almost 5 months ago in the fear and chaos of terror is tonight made permanent, a live evening program of news, interviews, and you. That's a change that has only happened because of the extraordinary outpouring of listener support for the kind of frank talk and aggressive exploration of issues that 9/11 required of this show and has now become a core to our DNA and our commitment to you. Tonight, we want to take a look back for a few minutes on the road we've traveled together and how it and you have shaped the show that is now On Point. Above all, On Point will be driven by the urgent issues that shape our world right out of the day's news, as we always have.
And one leader of the movement in the Hamas movement had likened the campaign, you know, brokered by the United States to the Crusades campaign.
And in addition, on the ground, it looks like 6 to 8 residents of the Rockaway area of Queens are still unaccounted for. I definitely saw a lot of bleak expressions on the faces of firefighters and emergency medical technicians as well. Some of them told me that this day seemed even harder than September 11th because of its memory and the idea of running into a disaster when you don't know how big it could be or become.
Beyond the news, we're committed to a daily, vigorous debate and analysis of what it all means. We don't pull punches, and we don't expect you or our guests to pull punches either.
Free marketeers want to privatize the jobs of the public servants, union members to a man and a woman, the people who were the heroes of September 11th. The unregulated market brought us Enron. It's the market. Cultural liberalism that menaces family values.
Andrew Sullivan, you've got our Jack Beatty in a high dudgeon here.
It's forever 1976 in Boston, isn't it?
I mean, oh, please.
It's like things have moved a little bit. Even the Democratic Party, of course.
Just as it's forever 1776 in your brain with Adam Smith and the theory of how things ought to be.
It's
anyway,
back and
Andrew,
forth to the
ahead.
Future here. Andrew Sullivan,
well,
how bad?
Well, happily, Jack, your own party has recognized reality and embraced a large amount of market economics and your own party
Paul,
put
let's
through
know what you think.
Reform.
Paul is on the line. Welcome, Paul. You're on the air.
In some ways, where our effectiveness is being harmed by the over-publicizing Bin Laden's statements and his picture in our faces constantly. We know who he is. there'll be a sufficient amount of information.
Unlike the caller before, I think that this has caused more fear in Americans, and honestly, I believe it was just propaganda to stir up more nationalism, more excitement, and more fear in Americans.
This was a departure from the FBI's prior anti-terrorism posture, which was not to round people up, to let plots go on, and only to intervene at the last minute. But, you know, you can turn that around and look at it from John Ashcroft's point of view. He saw a massive failure of the FBI's counterterrorism
program. We all did.
Yeah, and he may have just said, well, wait a minute.
As we have since September 11th, On Point will bring you the views of large figures from the national and world stage.
I think the prominent effect of our efforts in Afghanistan will depend quite heavily on how generous the United States and the rest of the world will be in rebuilding an Afghanistan that's almost totally destroyed.
Jimmy Carter, it's been a very difficult season. Are you hopeful for the world? Does peace have a chance?
Well, I think so. That's one of the main...
Benazir Bhutto, you witnessed the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and even Islamic violence firsthand for years. Were you surprised on September 11th?
I did expect there to be attack, but on a smaller scale. I was shocked when I watched the aeroplane go inside the Twin Towers. And I also had an awful feeling as I watched it that it had to do with my part of the world.
Thanks, Eddie, for your call. What about it, George McGovern? It's not just hunger, is it? There is something going on here in terms of a contest of values, a hatred. Do you track all that down to development?
You can't single out any one answer and say that's going to end terrorism. I would never argue that just providing enough food for people is going to terminate all terrorism in the world. There are other factors there.
And above all, On Point will stay true to our commitment to your voices, the most honest, unflinching views we air. Special coverage counted on you to keep us honest, focused, on point. On Point will do the same.
That's all for today, I said to the class, their confused faces blithely unaware of the morning's events. How do you tell a group of 13-year-olds from New York City that unknown assailants had destroyed their city's two largest buildings? The idea of the World Trade Center lying in ruins evaded my comprehension. What would it mean to them?
When I came here to the United States years ago, I made a lot of American friends, and I was amazed by how very successful women, career-wise, financially independent, but they were all the time obsessed with the bodies, with the dieting. They'd weigh themselves every morning.
Let's think about it. The lifestyle of young people in Marin, liberal, intellectual, and aware, is all talk in some ways. We aren't actually willing to renounce our education and our money for our beliefs. The only surprising thing about John Walker is that he actually took the next step. He decided to stop talking about his ideals and just do it.
Why the name On Point? It's just where the show has come. In ballet, On Point is up on your toes. In war, it's the lead soldier on patrol. In conversation, it's the heart of the matter. And that's where we intend to be. At the heart of the matter, On Point. Special coverage becomes On Point tonight because of you. Your urgent need to know the story behind the headlines, your generous sharing of your most intimate, honest views and questions. From our first night on the air, we've been committed to free speech, to a wide spectrum of views, to asking the hard questions and acknowledging difficult truths. All of that remains our commitment as On Point. We are honored and excited to be On Point with you. On Point is produced by Micheline Boudreau, Meghna Chakrabarty, Nate DeMeo, Graham Griffith, Eileen Imada, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Jim Moses, Tim Skog, and Isabella Tabarovsky. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.